This part of the Banking with Life podcast episode that you're about to enjoy is freely available, as it always has been. The full episode is available to our clients at bankingwithlife.com and to Ryan's clients at griggscapitalstrategies.com. In this episode, Ryan and I revisit CD Sisters and the characters in the play in light of recent client conversations. We had fun and hope you enjoy listening. Welcome to the Banking with Life podcast. I'm your host, James Nethery.
I'm Ryan Griggs, co-host.
Here it is, a beautiful Saturday morning, February.
I'm 1, tired. Are we done?
2025. And the reason he's saying that is, it's 12 o'clock Central as I speak. And we've been here talking since 9 a.m. And we'll share with maybe Incline Only Access in the future some of the good things that we've been talking about. So we've been here a minute talking.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. Let me start off by saying, if you don't have Becoming Your Own Banker, buy the physical book. Okay, forget all this electronic stuff. Get the physical book. The audiobook, Nelson isn't reading it. You're not going to hear his voice there. The Kindle versions, they don't show the illustrations. You have to get, there is no alternative.
No.
Pretend there's no alternative. There isn't an alternative. It's the physical paperback, fifth edition, black cover, Becoming Your Own Banker. Get that book, because the others, just, you're going to miss things. You're going to miss things anyway reading it. That's why you got to read it multiple times. You get the other restricted technological versions, and you're going to miss even more. So just do the physical book.
Or do both. You know, if you do the Audible, you do the digitally accessible, just, you got to have the physical book. There's no question. So, and you need a highlighter, in my opinion, and a notepad, yeah. Right? Because...
And what makes me bring that up is I've had the opportunity to listen to some unreleased recordings of Nelson. And so I'm going back through that, mapping out, like taking notes as I go through. And
no, I'm not jelly. I don't suffer from FOMO.
They're like from early 2000s recordings. And he's talking through at the part where I am in listening back through. He's talking about part three. What is now part three of Becoming Your Own Banker, how to start building your own banking system, on page 41. And there's multiple references in the text to the graphic and multiple calculations that if you're not like arithmetic calculations, that if you're not following in with the physical printed word, then you'll miss what's going on. I just thought, I'm going through a PhD program and writing a dissertation, and of course, haven't been in the business now 7 years. I mean, to think of a guy in the 80s, 90s, thinking of how to, before this was, I mean, he didn't have anything to work from, right? He just has his own experience. So to conceive of a way to communicate to somebody else what, quote unquote, banking with life insurance could mean, and what the, how to illustrate or demonstrate the financial reward to somebody, to structure that idea and to then give an example with that structure. That's just, as I was listening to him, like, this is so brilliant. Like, to conceive of this. It really was just, it's just remarkable. It makes me chuckle then at the people who are like, this is, what is it? It's too hokey, or it's, you know, it's, he's not a good writer. It's like, it's really quite, what we said before, it's just quite silly. But,
you know, listen, I can't help myself. The gentleman in the 70s and 80s, he didn't have anything to work from, right? And I mean, when I think through that, and I've thought through that many times, just Nelson, and trying to just think through his progression, specifically when it comes to life insurance and economics, you know, he buys his first policy at age 13. Actually, the policy was issued on him at his age 13. His daddy gave him the policy at age 14 and said, here, boy, this is yours, and you pay for it. And then he gets married to Mary, 20, 21 years of age. You know, he buys to my understanding, my recollection, my memory, he's already bought another policy on himself. And then he buys a round of policies on him and Mary when they're married. Excuse me. And so what are we're talking about 1951 by the time he's 20. Right. Mm. And so, and he's been paying premium. And I distinctly remember asking him, you know, one time, Nelson, why life insurance? All right. So this was, you know, really prior to everybody putting money in their 401ks, and, you know, mutual funds didn't really exist to the average all-American saver, which mutual funds are not saving, they're investing. And, you know, Nelson had experience in the markets, and I'm fully aware to a limited extent in which he did. But my point here that I want to make, and what I have often thought about, is he'd been paying life insurance premium a long time. And I'm not saying they were very big premiums. They were just strictly dividend paying whole life. The PUA only existed to receive a dividend. There was no dynamic PUA where you go up or down in premium. That didn't exist until the 90s. And they were ugly products when the life insurance companies first issued those. Just go ask anyone in the life insurance business that has a memory or experience. And I didn't, you know, I'm from older colleagues of mine that had, that were in the life insurance business at the time. Here, Nelson's been paying premium. And we talked about previously, you know, the first loans, several loans that he had made. And, you know, I'm asking Nelson, why life insurance? He said, James, it was the best financial advice I'd ever received, right? Okay, so he's paying all these premiums, and here's my point. He's paying these premiums. You know, he understands, or he learns through this what, you know, patient capital is, and he learns about Austrian economics, 1946, I believe, in Smithfield, Arkansas, at a Chamber of Commerce meeting when he was introduced to fee. And he's like, where are y'all hiding? Where are y'all been hiding this, right? And so he's an investor. He loves real estate. He's invested in real estate and timber, you know, timber's real estate. And he was an airplane pilot, so he knows something about velocity and vector and systems. I don't believe, and you know it, his book is in the first part of that, so I'm sure you got to listen to that in your private listening, you know, access, which is, I'm very proud that you have the opportunity and the ability to do that. He didn't just wake up in 1980 and say, oh my gosh, I should go borrow money from a life insurance company and put all this together of Austrian economics and, you know, life insurance in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s didn't have the negative connotation that it does today. Mm. People weren't afraid to pay premium, you know, as a, not only it's beyond a place to put money, they were buying the death benefit, life insurance, and then there was an endowment contract, the cash value would equal the death benefit in the future, and then they would take passive income, you know, or not, in quote unquote retirement. And I think the further away that we move from that systematic, methodical, disciplined activity of accumulating, building, the formation of capital. This, you know, you've done great work on capital. From the very beginning, you know, you said you've been in business 7 years. From the very beginning, you know, Nelson's an heir to Manger. And yeah, you, when he gets done with his PhD, and I've said it before, you know, and I'm not, you know, saying this just because he's here. I'm saying it because it's in fact true that, you know, he's going to slap the Austrians around with his PhD. Think I'm kidding? I'm not. And I'm, you know, I'm not the academic, but just the work that you've done on capital, right? And Nelson's Austrian background. And then his background owning life insurance. He didn't become a life insurance agent until 1964, right? And this, and I think it's relatively similar for all of us. When we're first exposed to this idea that you can become your own banker, what does that even mean? You know, and you start talking about capital, and capital has a need for a place to reside and a purpose. And then all the experience with the Resolution Trust Corporation and I guess that was the savings and loan debacle. That was all in the 70s, or was that in the 80s? That was in the 80s.
Yeah.
And then you have interest rates. If Nelson hadn't been paying a premium, multiple premiums over multiple years. Yes, he borrowed money against his cash values many times. If he hadn't been doing that and had his activity in real estate because he liked real estate, and then the pilot, and then the economics, none of this would have come together, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Couldn't have. But if he went through all that experience, right, even though economics and being a pilot and Resolution Trust Corporation, the savings and loans debacle, he would have been done and started all over from scratch if he hadn't been paying high premium life insurance. And it's like we try to jump over that today. We don't spend any time thinking through that. Generally, the TikTok marketers or all these young people, and maybe I don't know how they are, that are just creating these beautiful, short illustrations or presentations, and I'm not cracking on them, but it's like going to the grocery store, and we've talked about this many times, all the little tags hanging off the gondolas and the aisles, it's all to slap you in the face and buy me before you get to the register, and the end caps, and then, the end caps are at the registration or the checkout stand. It's like these short, beautiful presentations that focus on some narrow point, and even the noise does that. Well, the price of term or the price of permanent whole life insurance, and that you got to live or die on the price, term invested difference, and or you focus on the rate of return. The same or similar things occur within the infinite banking footprint. and I'm just saying here, trying to draw a correlation. I see the correlation in my mind, how this was a discovery process for Nelson Nash himself, right? And we all have a discovery process, no matter where we start, the premium, whatever. We discover as we continue to participate in proper capital formation,
yeah.
Right? And so
That can be challenging for me. I had this past week, I had a gentleman call or want to have an introductory call, which we did, and ran long. Of course, I blow right through my own timelines, but it just speaks. It's emblematic of a category of interactions that I have on occasion, maybe every other week or more than once a week, but with some regularity.
Some regularity,
where somebody will. Because on my little introductory form, as some of y'all will know, I ask what your experience with IBC is. Like, what have you done? Have you watched my mechanic series? Have you watched Becoming Your Own Banker? Have you read Becoming Your Banker? Have you watched the Banking with Life DVD? These kinds of things, right? And it's always fun when someone, and I ask if someone's read Becoming Your Own Banker, and I ask separately if they own a copy. And then I ask what their... How they would characterize their understanding of the IBC. And one of the options is, I know enough by now to get the gist of it. And so it always strikes me as puzzling when someone says they have not read Becoming Your Own Banker, that they don't own a copy, but that they do know enough to get the gist of it. That always is like, okay, these calls are going to be fun, right? It's always interesting. And this was one of those calls. Because what happens is people get pummeled with the social media clickbait stuff. They go online. They, get this little cute sort of glitzy, glamorous type presentation of how you can, be tricky with whole life. And
be tricky with whole life.
Yeah. And then they want to do it. And then they find those clickbaity type things raise questions. It's like, well, that doesn't quite make sense. And of course, they never do. So they keep looking for, something more systematic that's also online. And they come across the mechanic series. Some of y'all, I'm reading your story right now, right? and some might go on Reddit, and apparently people say nice things about me on Reddit. And anyway, they end up at the mechanic series, and they say, oh, that helped me understand better. And that's what causes them to want to talk to me in particular. Okay, so this was one of those gentlemen. And so we get on, And it's always, by the way, the number of people who want to get into real estate, I'm just amazed by this. There's a huge number of people who want to get, who aren't in real estate, but want to, which God bless, that could be great. Anyway, they want to get into real estate. And the way they see IBC or the way they see Whole Life is that they're going to pay the premium to build the cash value, to take the policy loan, to buy the property, and the property is going to pay rental income, and the rental income is going to be the premium.
Yeah.
And that's where that ends.
They jumped over the HELOC, got to squeeze the HELOC in there somewhere.
Right. And yes. Then there's all sorts of courses you can buy about like the best way to, you know, most cost-effective way to finance real estate. I get it. And people accuse us of like being against HELOCs. And it's like, okay, we're so missing the point. Like, we got to zoom back out. What ends up happening is Whole Life, done in some way with some relationship to quote unquote banking, becomes this little niche, tiny aspect of, you know, the portfolio, right? Or the financial activity. And, you know, people have said, you know, you want to meet the client where they're at, and, you know, starting somewhere is better than starting nowhere, and some cash value is better than none, and some premiums better. And I get all that, and I agree, and yes, yes, yes. But it's like, from my vantage point, it's like we're missing so much of the picture, so much of controlling. And with this last gentleman, sometimes I can't help myself. I just go off into this whole thing. And it's like, we are establishing an ownership position in the entity that is performing the banking function, which is to say responsible for originating and collecting repayment of credit. That is primarily what is happening. Now, the other stuff that comes later, like the investing and, you know, and Nelson talks about it. I mean, there's, you know, he goes and buys the land and he's got the capital to buy the land. He talks about the relationship between capital and opportunity, and all of that's also great. Don't get me wrong. I'm not discounting that, but it's all secondary to the original point, which was to just pay for the things that you're going to be paying for anyway for your own life. Like, it wasn't until, you know, well past the originally intended ending point of this call where I get the question, you know, so what sorts of things would I use policy loans for? Like, what do your clients like use policy loans for? And this question always makes me chuckle. I sometimes have to like hold back a response because it's like, well, what do you borrow money for? What do you pay for? It's all of those things. That is the starting point. In part three, which I've already mentioned, the CD sisters, all they're doing is buying a car for personal use. Just taking over ownership of the provision of credit for the purpose of buying a series of cars over a lifetime. And the result is massive. I mean, the results on method E, the IBC method, is a whole late life series of cash flow.
That wasn't going to go to them unless they did what they did.
Yeah, exactly. The magnitude of difference over the relevant time period, right, over the 44 years, over a person's lifetime, is massive. And you're going back to like the creativity of being able to construct that idea is just a worthy point all on its own. But it's like, that's where we start. I use the example sometime of, I don't know if Nelson had mentioned this or if you, I don't claim originality here, but, you know, it's like we're obsessed about how fast we can row the boat, ignoring the gaping holes in the bottom of the boat. Like, plug the holes. And in part three, how to start building your banking system, CD sisters, he acknowledges that the CD method looks better in the first 14 years, right? The total value of the CDs that the person is systematically building up and then liquidating is better than what is built up in that initial 14 years in the form of cash value and a policy. But he says, don't stop there. keep going. Like, look out further into the future, which is why don't be afraid to capitalize and think long range are integral rules of becoming your own banker. Because this, where this works out is over the long run. And so it just, you know, it's hard for me sometimes to address the idea from the typically real estate, but also potentially crypto type folks who are laser focused on that rate of return in the initial short term at the neglect of the long-term consequences of foregoing ownership of the banking function. It's like the frame of reference even is the frame of reference is different across the two. Like, we're looking at different things.
No question.
And so when this gentleman raised this point about, okay, well, where do policy loans come? And I start going into capital and the banking function and all this, you can like hear on the other, it's like, oh. In fact, he said multiple times, well, this is, like, what'd he say? I could feel the paradigm shifting or the light bulbs going off or like multiple times. And I'm like, yep.
Yep.
And there's a lot more where this came from.
That, you know, to look, I seen a friend or, you know, somebody sent me a video on, and it was TikTok or short, I think it was TikTok, where this young, very well-spoken, good-looking guy was talking about...
I don't remember making a TikTok. No, I'm kidding.
he was talking about, and very authoritatively, talking about, you know, these particular coins, you know, cryptos that are just blowing up, and they're going to blow up so much that you're really going to need to introduce the IBC. And that's why the friend sent it to me, because it was talking about IBC. And this young man, I mean, he just went deep into, it's like, okay, these are going to go, you know, if you have this much money in this position, or you've got this, you own this many coins, you know, and I don't really want to name the coins. It's probably like XRP or whatever. And it's going to go to $27 million. And then at that time, you know, you've got to be able to have in place, or you would want to at that time have in or put in place, you know, the exotic trust formations. Mm. And, you know, and we got the lowdown. We got the hookup with the people that can do all this, right? And then you want private, he didn't call it private placement life, which is exactly what it was. He was saying, you got to take those assets, take them to the insurance company. We're, you know, we've got all the connections to do this. So then you can borrow against these assets. And then talking about all the tax-free in conversation under 3 minutes of how you take this hope for projected $27 million windfall that you've got because you picked all the right coins and they did perform as he's explaining. And then the conversation going right through all of this complex, but he conveyed it in a very simple way, right? Very simplistic terms, complex trust work, then to get, you know, into a life insurance contract. All right. And if you think private placement, you know, you Google it up and you can go down the road on that and learn all you want about that. It's just another gimmick in the life insurance in the life insurance industry, my little humble opinion. And so he's creating in the mind of the listener all of these beautiful things, and he didn't know shite about either one of them to the point that he should be speaking about them, in my opinion. Anyway, it's all that quick stuff, though. You get 1 million views or whatever. I don't know how many views he had. And, you know, it's just what you've got to step over an awful lot of bull hockey out there in the big wide world to get to the meat, in my opinion. And here, I love, you know, we're talking about the CD sisters. And, you know, I just can't jump over, miss the opportunity. They spent 7 years capitalizing Illustrated. Nelson Illustrated, 7 years of premium. So they forego the new car that they wanted, the purchase, for 7 years. That right there eliminates about 90% of the people in the big wide world. I don't have the maturity, the intellectual maturity, the intestinal fortitude to say, no, thank you. I want to build capital. And I know this is an illustration. I get it. And I actually know what happens in year eight and beyond. Was that premium paid or was that premium not paid? Was that policy, did they use an option, an exercise, a contractual, not an option, not an option? Did they exercise a contractual right that exists only in whole life insurance? Did they reduce pay up? Did they premium offset? You know, what's going on there? It's a beautiful illustration. I'm not picking the illustration. I'm just saying that that's one page of an illustration. And most people, agents included, don't really know what's going on there. And I'm only bringing that up to tie back to comments that I make, and I will never quit making them. Structure matters. All right. But let me say, too, that you can bet these girls didn't buy this life insurance policy so they could finance a car in 7 years. No, they bought life insurance for the death benefit and the cash value. Right. And then Nelson, you know, compared with the CD rates and all that in 14 years before, you know, the deferred pleasure, the deferred ability to continue buying car, controlling the banking function, is 14 years before the life insurance policy I pay. That's going to knock out about half of the other, about half of the 10% that remains. If the ability to forego pleasure for 7 years, 8, 9, or 10 years, whatever that may be, knocks out 90% of the people. And then it takes them another 7 years before this method is clearly and indisputably a better choice with better results. Another 7 years to clearly be able to demonstrate that, right, numerically. That's going to knock out, I don't know. I'm just saying half of the other 10% that remained. And I think it's important. If you don't have the ability to either apply your discipline, create discipline, and then stick to it and pay a premium, this is probably not a good idea for you. And I'm not a shill for the life insurance companies, but you can't get into the banking. You can't control the banking function unless you control capital. And you giving me money in a third-party agreement is not, and then me going applying that and maybe even re-lending it or whatever, is not controlling the banking function. The man who originated the loan, the individual, the entity, they're controlling the banking function. Anyways, I just want to point that out. And then, quite frankly, you know, you got to go through one before you can get to two. And you got to go through one and two before you get to three, and this is nothing new. I'm just going back a couple of pages and to creating the entity, and I believe this is in section two, page 38 in Nelson's book. He gives you the scale, right, from MEC to term. He tells you very clearly, we've highlighted it, we've talked about it on this, we've done presentations on it. In the left side of the page of 38, going down to about the 1, 2, 3, the fourth paragraph, the bottom, it's in italics. He's screaming at you. Read this, right? The shorter the payment period, the better suited it is for the purposes of the infinite banking concept. Okay. Okay, does that mean that you don't want the contractual right to pay a premium beyond year eight with CD Sisters, beyond year four with equipment financing? No, no, it doesn't. And I just want to say that he is pointing out the in the next column, the right side of the page, I believe the second paragraph, right underneath the scale, when using this type of life insurance to solve your need for banking, it is best to select a plan, in parentheses, the base policy, that is in the middle of the scale, more parentheses, such as ordinary life or life paid up at age 65, and then add a paid up additions rider to the plan. And I'm pointing this out on purpose because the ordinary life in 2000 was paid to 100, right? It's an ordinary health as a base, or paid to age 65. And that, even that decision to use which one of, if those are, you know, is based on your individual situation, where you are at. How much duration do you have left? You're going to ask a guy age 60 to buy a paid up at age 65? No. Right? Someone 5 or 10 years of age, paid up 65? Maybe. I don't know. And I don't want to get too far off under that. He's printed out the scale. He said the shorter the term, the better for banking. And then he tells you to either buy paid up at age 65 as a base policy or paid to 100, which is now a paid to age 121 because of life expectancy. We're living longer. All right. And then add a PUA.
Yeah. And you've mentioned in the past too that like things have changed, and you're talking about the difference in life expectancy now and the increase from 100 to 121. I mean, in my world, we use traditional pay whole life policies. I know you do too. But pay to 95, pay to 100, pay to 121. Very long payment time plans. You know, I had a call with, this was earlier this week, so end of January of 25. And this individual already owns a policy from that he acquired through his quote unquote broker. I don't ever ask who these people are. I don't really care, right? 10-year term rider. He's on year 8, and he's in his early 40s, maybe late 30s. Younger guy, right?
Worse.
So I think it was in 2028 where...
2018?
No. In 2028, rider's okay. Falling off.
I got it.
Has to pull back on the PUA to maintain non-MEC status. Small base. Right, 25-75 structure, and you can bet that the term is included in the 25, right? So 25% of total outlay to, or it may have been no term rider. In any case, whatever the reason.
The blended PUA.
You needed to pull back on PUA at the end of the 10th year.
Yeah.
In order to maintain non-MEC status. Because insufficiently long dated term rider and insufficiently large base premium. And so his monthly outlay was going to go from 17, and of course, it's a company that requires PUA to be paid on a scheduled basis, which you don't have to have. But anyway, that was the case for him. So his
PUA.
So his $1,700 monthly outlay was going to go down to $450.
Well, I bet his income hadn't gone up either.
Of course, his income had gone up in the meantime.
It ain't going to go up in the future either. He's in his 30s or 40s. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what he told me?
No, what?
He's like, you know, when I first got this policy, that's what I wanted. I wanted, you know, high early cash value. Yeah. And he says, since that time, it's like, this is the reason I'm coming to you, is because I now recognize that I want to be able to pay for longer.
What?
And it's like, well, I'm so glad that you talked to the other guy 8 years ago and now you're talking to me. Because that's what we do. That is infinite banking, that thinking long range is part of the game here. And so, yeah, he'll be in his early 40s. He's not now. He will be in his early 40s. And on this one policy, he has to pull way back on the premium payment. So taking this to the question of how long of a timeline do you want over which to pay base premium? It's like, why wouldn't you want that? A different call towards the end of the advisory process, about to go into underwriting. You know, we've started to sort out what the premium outlay is. We know what the structure is going to be. And so he just raised, you know, he's of course seen stuff online. And he's like, so, you know, how long is this? You know, I've seen the different like periods at which base premium is no longer payable, and I'm putting it in my words, but he's essentially getting at this idea. And he says, so what, like, how do we figure that out? Like, which one should I do? And so I told him, look, if you start with a more limited pay policy, and that policy goes in force, there's no changing that. Like, if it's a pay to 65, when you get to 65, by God, that's the last year in which premium is going to be paid.
Yeah.
Now, suppose, just go with me here for a moment. Suppose that when you start, say at age 45, and you get 20 years into the policy, suppose you really quite like that relationship between the annual cash value growth and the annual premium. Suppose that the annual cash value growth is a multiple of the annual premium payment. And suppose that you might like for that to continue at the greatest magnitude possible for as long as you've got money to pay premium, right? Or if you, which is to say, as long as you have incoming cash flow. Just maybe, right? Okay, with a pay to 65, you're done. At 65, you're done. You're done paying the premium. There's going to be dividends. Sure, that's going to go to PWA. Great. Cash value will continue to grow. Death benefit can continue to go up. Great. Or you could have start out with from the beginning, because you have to start out with it from the beginning, because there's no changing this once the policy's in force. So you start out at the beginning with the longer pay, traditional, ordinary, dividend paying whole life, paid in 95, 100, 121, some late age, well past natural mortality. And maybe you get to 65 and you decide, gosh, I really just don't like all that cash value growth in a given year. You know, this idea of paying in X and having the value of the asset go up by a multiple of X, all in a tax-free environment, all accessible tax-free. I don't like that. I want to cut that off. I want to stop doing that. I want for this to be as though I was restricted to a limited pay type policy. Well, my gosh, you can have that. You can reduce pay up a longer pay policy down to this truncated type thing if you want to. We preserve that flexibility. Because you could take it a step further and say, well, maybe there's just a permanent cessation of income. There's just no more incoming cash flow at, let's say, 65 or whenever it is, the end of the limited pay timeline, the 20 pay, you know, out 20 years from now, whenever it might be. There's just nothing coming in. There's no Social Security. There's no money from investments. You just have no incoming cash flow at all. Permanent, devastating end to all incoming cash flow. And you cannot, even though you want to, pay additional premium. Fine. A longer pay policy is built with sufficient flexibility to then end that payment earlier. But you don't have to. You're not required to. You're not shut down because that was the nature of the construct from the beginning. We preserve the flexibility. We preserve the option to continue to pay. Why might you want to continue to pay? Well, we've already alluded to the fact that if my cash value is growing at a multiple of the premium per year, maybe I'd like to pay more in premium. And why would that be? Well, as it turns out, dividends on dividend paying whole life is not singular. There's a dividend calculated with respect to your base premium payment. There's a dividend calculated with respect to your PUA rider premium payment. And as it turns out, the dividend calculated with respect to the base premium is greater than the dividend calculated with respect to your PUA premium. Why would that be? Well, because PUA premium is immediately liquid. You're going to get the PUA amount paid less the PUA expense charge in cash value when the company's done processing the payment. Highly liquid. Company has to account for that liquidity. That's essentially a guaranteed loan offer to you, and they have to account for the possibility that you will exercise that right. So in their actuarial accounting and in their future projections, they have to make sure to reserve money to meet those potential draws on liquidity. Therefore, there's less in surplus generated to the company. PUA premium dollars contribute less to surplus than do base premium dollars. And so your share as part owner, as residual claimant, as owner in a mutual entity, your share of the surplus generated will be less in proportion to your PUA payments than it is for your base premium payments. So if I get to the end of whenever I can pay PUA premium, which hopefully is a long time, 20, 30 years, and I have this prospect of continuing to pay premium in the form of now base premium alone, well, it stands to reason that my continued payment of additional base premium dollars will further increase my dividends, which means further increase cash value growth. So why wouldn't I want that? And the only answer is I'm not paying attention to it. The only answer is I've been taught explicitly or implicitly through social media conditioning to focus on the ultra short term. And I've got this wonderful, profligate American culture that supports me in doing that. That's the reason. And when you start poking at that and say, oh, hey, out here, look, by the way, 92-page book written in lay person English, little basic rules, think long range, don't be afraid to capitalize. When you start literally genuine, not just like conceiving of the idea of thinking long range, but when you actually technically, practically start thinking long range, your values change. What you care about changes. The urgency to have maximum cash value right now becomes situated, maybe even subjugated, in this longer term context. And as we started off here, CD Sisters Part 3, that's where the value comes in IBC, is over the long term. So that's where the thinking should be anyway. So if you're in becoming your own banker, if you're paying attention to what Nelson says, if you're following his rules, that's where the mind should be guided. And so the when it comes to then selecting how long you want to pay base premiums, it's as long as possible, as long as what the company's going to offer me. Because I want the ability to contribute to the financial surplus of my company. My company in the sense of the company which sold you the policy, and my company in the sense of by owning a policy, I'm part owner of the company. I want to continue to contribute. I want to walk out the front door of the grocery store with all my produce, all my cans of peas, all my groceries for as long as possible. I want to do that when I'm 40. I want to do it when I'm 80. Why? Because the more I walk out the front door and pay the price at retail, if not higher than what I'm charging customers, the more I'm contributing to the revenue of the business, and the more profitable that business is, the greater my share of that profit in the form of dividend payments. And in the whole life world, that means the greater cash value I get. And then when late life comes around and it's time for some passive cash flow, I'm gonna enjoy some of that to some degree that I want from my set of policies. And what I don't take, I leave to my people in the form of a tax-free death benefit payment. Why wouldn't you want all that?
Yeah, I don't even need to read Nelson's book. Just listen to that.
Thank you for joining us on the Banking with Life podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to like and subscribe and click on that little notification bell. Otherwise, join us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher for weekly content.